take your copy of God's Word and open to Daniel chapter 6. Daniel chapter 6. I hope that you are enjoying our study of the book of Daniel. It is a good book. And we're about halfway through. This, Lord willing, today will be about the halfway point. And I really don't think it'll take us much longer just to get through the other half. There is a chapter or two there that are a little bit technical, and I haven't yet found out exactly how I'm going to deal with those. But nevertheless, I hope that you are really enjoying this book. We'll begin reading today in verse 14. Daniel chapter 6, verse 14. Then the king, when he heard these words, was much distressed and set his mind to deliver Daniel. And he labored till the sun went down to rescue him. Then these men came by agreement to the king and said to the king, "Know, O king, that it is a law of the Medes and Persians that no injunction or ordinance that the king establishes can be changed." Then the king commanded, and Daniel was brought and cast into the den of lions. The king declared to Daniel, "May your God, whom you serve continually, deliver you." And a stone was brought and laid on the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet and with the signet of his lords, that nothing might be changed concerning Daniel. Then the king went to his palace and spent the night fasting, with no diversions brought to him, and sleep fled from him. Then, at break of day, the king arose and went in haste to the den of lions. As he came near to the den where Daniel was, he cried out in a tone of anguish. The king declared to Daniel, "O Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to deliver you from the lions?" Then Daniel said to the king, "O king, live forever. My God sent his angel and shut the lions' mouths, and they have not harmed me because I was found blameless before him and also before you, O king. I've done no harm." Then the king was exceedingly glad and commanded that Daniel be taken up out of the den. So Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no kind of harm was found on him because he had trusted in his God. And the king commanded, and those men who had maliciously accused Daniel were brought and cast into the den of lions, they, their children, and their wives. And before they reached the bottom of the den, the lions overpowered them and broke all their bones in pieces. Then King Darius wrote to all the peoples, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, "Peace be multiplied to you. I make a decree that in all my royal dominion, people are to tremble and fear before the God of Daniel. For he is the living God, enduring forever. His kingdom shall never be destroyed, and his dominion shall be to the end. He delivers and rescues. He works signs and wonders in heaven and on earth. He who has saved Daniel from the power of the lions." So this Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius and the reign of Cyrus the Persian. Some 600 years after the events here in Daniel chapter 6, James wrote this: "For where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there will be disorder and every vile practice." James chapter 3, verse 16. If this chapter is not proof of that, I don't know what is proof. Now, in case you weren't here last week, let me remind you what's going on here. The Babylonian kingdom has fallen. We saw that back in chapter 5 with the handwriting on the wall when Belshazzar was executed. At this point, we are probably a couple of years into the reign of Darius, a couple of years into the Medo-Persian Empire. It would have taken some time to get this government in place that we see in place here. Now, amazingly, Darius has elevated Daniel to a very high position. And Daniel is probably 85 years old or so at this point. And Darius was actually planning to elevate him a little higher into a position somewhat like our vice president today. Well, you know what happens in politics. The rest of the rulers, the satraps as they're called here, they became jealous and came up with this plot to have Daniel killed. They played on the king's ego. They went to the king and they told him he needed to pass a law that nobody could pray to any man or God for 30 days, but only to him. And they sort of held his foot to the fire, so to speak, and they talked him into signing this edict. And at that time, a law that was signed by the king, which we even saw mentioned here, couldn't be changed. Once it was written, it's as though it was written in stone. So then, this law is passed, and these men laid in wait, ready to watch Daniel, ready to catch him in prayer to Yahweh. Well, they didn't have to wait long, because Daniel just continued right on doing the things that he had already been doing. Verse 10 says he got down on his knees three times a day and prayed and gave thanks before his God. Here's the key point. As he had done previously. He wasn't doing this to spite them. He was just going on with normal life. Well, these men saw it. And so they take off to the king and they want to make sure that the law has been signed. And the king assured them that it had been signed. And once they were sure that it had been signed, they charged Daniel with treason. Here's what they said. Daniel, who is one of the exiles from Judah, pays no attention to you, O king, or the injunction you have signed, but makes his petition three times a day. And that's where we leave off there in verse 13, where we ended last week. The name of the sermon this morning is, last week was an envious plot. This week is an envious plot backfired. Or, as my lovely wife might say, in your face. That's what they really get here. What they pass blows up in their face. We're going to see Daniel rescued, and we're going to see these perpetrators face the consequences of their crime. This is pretty rich, actually, so let's get into it. So verse 14 tells us that when the king heard these words, they heard this, that Daniel had broken this law, he was much distressed and set his mind to deliver Daniel, and he labored till the sun went down to rescue him. Regret. That's what the king is feeling here. That's what's going on. He hates that this has happened. He hates that he has signed this into law, and now his best counselor is probably going to be put to death. Jeffrey King writes, quote, "Some of us are very good at kicking other people, but it's a good thing to kick yourself sometimes," end quote. That's what's going on here. The king could have kicked himself for having been so prideful as to sign this ridiculous law. But even more, I think he was really frustrated with himself for allowing these bunch of no good politicians to sign him or to sign this into law, and now had him stuck. He actually ended up being a tool of those guys instead of the king. And I have a feeling he's pretty ticked off at them, and I think the chapter will bear that out. It says here that he labored till the sun went down to rescue Daniel. He tried to look at the law from every angle, I'm sure, to try to find some loophole through which Daniel could be delivered. I'm sure he called whatever is the equivalent of a lawyer today. And he tried to find a way that the law perhaps could have been changed or Daniel could have been released. He wanted so much to deliver Daniel from being thrown in the lion's den, but that was not God's plan. God was going to deliver him, all right, but in a way that glorified God. Well, apparently transgressions of the law back in their time, unlike ours, had to be dealt with speedily. He labored till the sun went down, but that's when the time was over. That evening, Daniel was proven to be guilty. That evening, Daniel had to be cast into the den of lions. And so it says in verse 15, then these men came to the king and said to the king, "Know, O king, that it is a law of the Medes and Persians that no injunction or ordinance that the king establishes can be changed." Here they come again. I'm sure he hated to see them coming. And note, they came by agreement. It says the same thing back in verse 6. It says the same thing in verse 11. This could be translated to say, these men came by thronging to the king. In other words, they rushed in as a group, urging the king to do what the law demanded that he is to do. And notice what they tell him. Hey, Darius, king, you know the law of the Medes and Persians, once the king signs off on it, it can't be changed. You know that, right? Yeah, he knew that. That's why he had worked so hard all afternoon trying to find a way to deliver Daniel. He knew that. I seriously doubt that they improved the king's mood or his attitude towards them by reminding him of that. It was that law that had him so sick at this point. And by the way, it is this law that separates him from Nebuchadnezzar, who could have changed it. Nebuchadnezzar was the final rule. Darius, though, was subject to the law. He was not an absolute dictator like Nebuchadnezzar. Now look, the king knows he's been duped by them at this point. He realizes that. Nevertheless, the law has been signed and Daniel had clearly violated the law. The punishment has to be carried out because it can't be changed. The king can't do anything else. So verse 16 says, then the king commanded, Daniel was brought and cast into the den of lions, and the king declared to Daniel, "May your God, whom you serve continually, deliver you." Darius's hands were tied. My dad would have said he'd made his bed and now he had to lay it. He committed the crime himself and now he's going to have to do the time, so to speak. Except this time, the crime was making a law that condemned a good man, Daniel. So Darius has him cast into the den of lions, but not without a word of encouragement to Daniel. Did you catch that? The king declared to Daniel, "May your God, whom you serve continually, deliver you." I studied this phrase, this sentence a little bit. There's more here. It's not as easy as you might think. In fact, if you're reading a New King James, it probably reads something similar to, "Your God, whom you constantly serve, will himself deliver you." Or the New American Standard, Tim, if you're reading that, it's probably something like that. King James, I think, says that. Though Darius being a pagan king, it's very difficult to think that he was so confident that Yahweh was going to deliver Daniel here. I'm certain that he hoped that he would, but I doubt that he was that sure. John Walford offers another translation that may answer all of those questions. Here's what he offered. "Thy God, whom thou servest continually, he must deliver you." In other words, what Darius is saying here in this phrase is, "Daniel, I've done all I can do. I've looked at the law from every possible viewpoint that I can look for. I have tried my best to deliver you before this point. There's nothing I can do at this point. I'm sorry. Now it's in God's hand." I think that's probably what he's saying. That certainly makes the most sense, being that he is a pagan monarch. But he certainly does seem to have some hope that Yahweh would deliver Daniel. I think we'll see that when he runs into the den the next morning. He's hoping that Daniel would live through this. And by the way, did you catch his description of Daniel here? He said that Daniel could be described as one who serves God continually. What an example Daniel is for us. But Daniel didn't take days off from serving God. He served God every day. Now, what was Daniel thinking in the midst of all this? I don't know. The text doesn't say. He was an 80-plus year old man by this point. He may have been thinking, hey, you know what? If this is the way I got to go, so be it. I've had a great life. God's been very good to me. Or maybe perhaps God had given him some assurance by this point that he was going to be delivered. We aren't told. Or maybe he felt like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego felt when they were about to be cast into the burning fiery furnace. You remember what they told Nebuchadnezzar? If this be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he'll deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, we still aren't bowing down to your gods. Maybe that was Daniel's attitude. We know this. His resolve was still firm. He still maintained or retained his Christian character and his integrity and without question his faith. His faith went nowhere. So verse 17 tells us that a stone was brought and laid over the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet ring and with the signet ring of his nobles so that nothing would be changed in regard to Daniel. No gimmicks, no tricks here. There was no doubt as to whether somebody snuck in and removed the lines or snuck in and removed Daniel. He wasn't going to be rescued by man. This stone is laid over the mouth of the den. It's sealed not only by the king, but by his nobles as well. And it was done so that nothing could be changed in regard to Daniel. We got to make sure this guy faces the consequences of his crime. Do you remember what the chief priests and the Pharisees did when they came to Pilate after Jesus had been crucified and laid in a tomb? Matthew informs us that they go to Pilate, and here's what they say. Sir, we remember how that impostor said while he was still alive, after 3 days I will rise. Therefore, order the tomb to be made secure until the third day, lest his disciples go and steal him away and tell the people he is risen from the dead, and the last fraud will be worse than the first. They wanted Jesus' tomb sealed. Pilate allows it. He actually gives them a guard of soldiers, and they made it secure by sealing it, much the same way that we see this stone secured here. What's the use in that? Well, in both cases, they wanted proof that no hocus pocus was pulled. And what ends up happening is what these perpetrators meant for evil, God actually uses for further proof that a miracle has happened in both cases. Daniel actually did face the lions because it was sealed not only with the king's ring, but also with the ring of his nobles. He was there all night in the lion's den, no question. And the same with Jesus. Jesus is really risen from the dead. See, man tries his best to disprove God's involvement in this world, and what he ends up proving is that God is very active in the world. Well, let's move on here. Verse 18 says that the king went off to his palace, and he spent the night fasting. That's interesting. And no entertainment was brought before him, and his sleep fled from him. Now, I think I told you last week, as far as kings go, Darius is a rather likable guy. I mean, the encouragement that he gives Daniel is significant there. And I think what we're going to see from him in the rest of the chapter tells you about his character. I mean, this is a guy you probably wouldn't mind playing around a golf with. He's a nice guy. So he's caught by these political pirates in a moment of weakness when they preyed on his pride, and now he has all this grief because his best counselor, Daniel, is in a lion's den. I am certain that Darius had been a party to a bunch of criminals being executed by this point. And I'll bet you that in every other one, he never gave it a second thought. But this time it bothers him. This time, an innocent man is being executed. He had a great love for Daniel, and that's very apparent because he wasn't able to sleep here this evening. He spent the night fasting for a Jewish exile. A prisoner of war. He spent the night fasting for a person that was part of a people group that had been conquered and essentially was brought back to Babylon as a slave. What's the likelihood of that? Slim to none, except that God was in all of this. And I can only assume if he spent the night fasting that he didn't waste it. He actually prayed along at the same time. I mean, I have to wonder, was he praying to Yahweh? Maybe. I'm not suggesting he was converted. The text is not actually 100% conclusive about that, though he certainly may have been. He could have been praying to Yahweh as simply one of the gods, but we know from everything he says throughout this chapter that Daniel had been very clear in telling him who the true God is, the living God. And understand, kings at this time were the upper class, and everybody else was the lower class. There was no middle class. He lived a very luxurious lifestyle. And he normally had entertainment in the evening. This would have included feasting, instrumental music, dancing girls, concubines, whatever the king wanted. But this night, he didn't want any of it. And it seems he laid down in his bed and he tried to sleep. But he laid there all night with his eyes open. No doubt, thinking through how he got himself in this whole mess. And I'm certain that he had much regret all night. And so verse 19 says, "Then at the break of day, the king arose and went in haste to the den of lions. As he came near to the den where Daniel was, he cried out in a tone of anguish. The king declared to Daniel, 'O Daniel, servant of the living God.'" You see, Daniel had told him about God. "Servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to deliver you from the lions?" Then Daniel said to the king, "O king, live forever. My God has sent his angel and shut the lion's mouth, and they have not harmed me because I was found blameless before him and also before you, O king. I have done no harm." I mean, it seems that right at the moment that light first breaks through, he's not sleeping anyway, Darius takes off and runs in haste to the den of lions. I'm sure this night seemed like a very long night for him. I don't know how many of you have ever woke up at 12:30 thinking it was 5. You wake up at 12:30 and you lay there till 3, and it seems like weeks trying to get back to sleep. I know that that's how this night was to him. And it sounds like this old 64, 65-year-old king does something that I wouldn't think 64, 65-year-old kings generally did. And he takes off running. He's anxious. He runs to the lion's den. And it seems he has a little hope anyway. Maybe Daniel's still alive. He he had a little hope that Yahweh had actually delivered Daniel. And he arrives at the lion's den, and he says here in our text that he cried out to Daniel in a tone of anguish, or even, as the New King James puts it, he cried out in a lamenting voice to Daniel. It seems he was hoping for the best, but maybe expecting the worst. So he asked Daniel if God's been able to deliver him from the lions, and he had to be ecstatic when Daniel responds. I'm sure that he's thrilled that he still had his best counselor, the guy that he had leaned on, the one that he wanted to raise up to be a vice monarch, a vice president, so to speak. And I'm sure that his conscience had to have been relieved, because it was really his fault that Daniel had ended up down there in the lion's den. Charles Spurgeon once said, quote, "It's a good thing those lions didn't try to eat Daniel. They would not have enjoyed him, for he was half grit and the other half backbone." End quote. I thought that was pretty good. Daniel replies to the king, "O king, live forever." Now I'm just going to tell you, some of us would have said, "Yeah, I'm still here, you scoundrel. I live through this mess you put me through." That's not what Daniel does. He is ever respectful to his superiors. "O king, live forever. My God sent his angel and shut the lions' mouths, and they have not harmed me because I was found blameless before him." Now look, Daniel had broken man's law. Remember that. He was guilty in that sense. But in that case, he was right to do so, because man's law had contradicted God's law. And so Daniel followed God's law. Remember what the apostles said when they were told not to preach in the name of Jesus anymore? They replied to those leaders of the Jews. They said, "We must obey God rather than men." And that's what Daniel does here. I told you last week, we are to follow man's law as long as it doesn't require us to break God's instruction to us. If the law of the land demands that we do something God tells us not to do, or if man's law requires us to not to do something that God tells us to do, then we balk at man's law. Otherwise, we follow the laws of the land. We live peacefully amongst the world. Well, in this instance, the law of Darius had told him to stop praying to Yahweh, and Daniel balked. And he prayed three times a day, just like he had done before. And yet God had found him blameless, because God's law supersedes man's law. It is a higher law. But not only to that, Daniel tells the king that he hadn't done him any harm either. He not only had not wronged God, he had not wronged Darius. You say, well, how is that? He broke Darius's law. Let me explain. Daniel had not stopped praying when the law demanded he stop. That's why he's in the lion's den, right? But even in this, he had done Darius no wrong. On the contrary, I think he had done much good for Darius. You see, Jeremiah had written to these Jewish exiles that were originally deported to Babylon and now are in Medo-Persia. He had written to them in Jeremiah 29, and here's what he said. "Seek the welfare of the city where I sent you into exile and pray to the Lord on its behalf." What was Daniel doing? He was praying. You think he was following the instruction of Jeremiah? We know he had a copy of it. I believe he was. Daniel was a scholar. He was a theologian. "Pray to the Lord on its behalf, for in its welfare you will find your welfare." That's Jeremiah 29:7, by the way. I have no doubt that Daniel was praying for the Medo-Persian kingdom. And I have no doubt he was praying for the king as well. So he had not wronged Darius. In fact, he had done as good a thing as he could do for Darius. He had prayed for him. Let that be an example for us. And who is this angel that's sent? He says, God sent his angel and stopped the mouths of the lions. Well, we're not 100% sure. Was it merely one of the heavenly hosts? It could have been, certainly. Or maybe it was the angel of the Lord. The text is not specific enough to know for sure. This we do know, Daniel knew he was there. He knew how it happened. He probably saw him much the way that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego had seen the fourth man in the fire with them. And he certainly could have been that very same one who rescued Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And we assume that that is a pre-incarnate appearance of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. That may very well have been who Daniel was with. I don't believe Daniel had near the problem getting through the night that Darius had getting through it. So verse 23 says that the king was exceedingly glad. And he commanded that Daniel be taken up out of the den. So Daniel was taken up out of the den and no kind of harm was found on him because he had trusted in his God. So back in chapter 3, after Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego had been saved from the fiery furnace, it said the hair of their heads was not singed, their cloaks were not harmed, and no smell of fire was upon them. Now they take Daniel out of the lion's den. And they inspect him. And I'm sure it was shocking to those people nearby to find that no kind of harm was found on him. What was Daniel's attitude towards God through this whole ordeal? It says right here in the text, he trusted his God. He trusted his God. The writer of Hebrews mentions Daniel. Not by name, but surely it is Daniel he is speaking about. Chapter 11, verse 32 of Hebrews says this, "What more shall I say? For time would fail me to tell of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, of David, and Samuel, and all the prophets who, through faith, conquered kingdoms, enforced justice, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions." That has to be Daniel. So Daniel is said here to have, through faith, stopped the mouth of lions. Daniel's trust, as it's worded here in the Hebrew Old Testament, his trust then is defined in Greek as faith. Daniel had faith. And not just faith of being delivered from the lion's den. Look, folks, he had faith in the coming Messiah. He had faith in the sacrifice of the Son of David for his sins. He had faith in the resurrecting power of the Son of David. Daniel was a scholar. He knew the Old Testament. He knew the prophecies. And according to this, he believed them. He believed them. So verse 24 takes a little turn. The king commanded those men who had maliciously accused Daniel were brought and cast into the den of lions. They, their children and their wives. And before they reached the bottom of the den, the lions overpowered them, broke all their bones in pieces. According to history, this is just standard policy. You commit the crime, your whole family suffers the penalty. You say, that's not fair. Well, we actually see that in the case of the Lord a few times with those that transgressed against Moses and Aaron, their whole families suffered for that crime. It's certainly a deterrent to crime if you know that not only you are going to suffer, but your wife and children are going to suffer as well. And by the way, if you thought that Daniel just hit it lucky and happened to be in the lion's den when these lions weren't hungry, think again. This text proves otherwise. These lions pounced on this breakfast, mauling these people before they even reached the bottom of the pen. They are starving to death because they hadn't eaten Daniel. Leon Wood writes, quote, "These men had wronged not only Daniel, but also the king. They had insulted him by using him through trickery to accomplish their purpose. It is likely that the king would have so punished them even if Daniel had died." One wonders at the intelligence of men who could not have realized this possibility from the first, end quote. How could they not know they're going to be punished? This Daniel was the right-hand man. If the king had have come to the den of lions the next morning and Daniel is gone, all but his bones, these men would have probably been thrown in anyway. How boneheaded. Now, how many people were cast in? I don't know. There's no way to know. Was it all 120 satraps and their families? Possibly, but not likely. Maybe it was just those that were the ringleaders in the whole plot. The two that served alongside Daniel maybe were the primary ringleaders, and then maybe some of those satraps that were located there in the city of Babylon. The text just does not tell us. Some have said, well, this is not possible to have thrown in this many people to be a meal for these lions. Well, how many lions were there? The text doesn't say. We don't know. We don't know how big this den actually was. And they may have thrown these people into the den in some type of order. You know, maybe they threw in three or four and then waited a couple of 2 or 3 hours and threw in some more. We don't know. Nevertheless, if I had to guess, I would say this was the leaders of this whole plot. And this was done so that the king could show them that they better leave Daniel alone. Because Daniel was his right-hand man. Look, it's possible that some of the satraps in the outlying areas didn't even realize that this was done. But the ones there in the city did. Now, I'll tell you, as I study this passage, we read through the book of Ezra as a church body not too long ago on Sunday mornings. It is near impossible not to be reminded of Haman. You know, the one that was going to have Mordecai hung on the gallows. He builds these gallows. He's planning to have Mordecai, the Jew, hung on them. And 24 hours rolls around and he finds himself swinging on the gallows instead. Very similar. Very similar. Well, this chapter ends with a great encouragement from Darius. It says in verse 25, "Then King Darius wrote to all the peoples, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, 'Peace be multiplied to you. I make a decree that in all my royal dominion, people are to tremble and fear before the God of Daniel, for He is the living God, enduring forever. His kingdom shall never be destroyed, and His dominion shall be to the end. He delivers and rescues. He works signs and wonders in heaven and on earth. He who has saved Daniel from the power of the lions." Well, this is just deja vu all over again, as Yogi Berra would say. Nebuchadnezzar has already written a decree to all of this empire. And like Nebuchadnezzar, Darius realizes a miracle when he sees one. So he issues this proclamation to all peoples, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth. Now, he doesn't literally mean all the earth here, but he means all of the area that was controlled by the Medo-Persian Empire, and it was a significant area. Significantly bigger than Babylon, by the way. And this is a decree, much like the one that was made in the earlier part of the chapter, which I'm assuming could not be changed because the king signed off on it. In fact, this sounds a lot like the decree that Nebuchadnezzar had issued after the fiery furnace incident in chapter 3. Darius here decrees that the citizens of the empire tremble and fear before the Lord. Unlike the pagan gods, Yahweh is the living God. Darius declares that God is enduring forever. He goes on to say that God's kingdom shall never be destroyed and His dominion shall be to the end. It really sounds like the post-conversion Nebuchadnezzar of chapter 4, if you ask me. Now remember, this realm had changed hands. The Babylonian kingdom had given way to the Medo-Persian kingdom. The head of gold was gone, and now the chest and arms of silver were in charge. But God had not been released of His duty. He was still sitting on His throne then, and by the way, He is still sitting on His throne now. He goes on to say that God delivers and rescues. He works signs and wonders in heaven and on earth. He who has saved Daniel from the power of the lions. It seems to me that Darius is well aware that Yahweh's power extended way beyond the borders of Israel. See, back at that time, they believed that a god pretty much just ruled over his own little area. But here's Yahweh, hundreds of miles away from Israel, delivering Daniel from the lion's den in Babel. God, Yahweh, is different. Was Darius converted? There's not enough to know for sure, but it's certainly possible. This is greatly encouraging, the things that he has to say here. Without question, he is greatly impressed. Well, the chapter ends just by saying this Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius and the reign of Cyrus the Persian. Now, I told you last week that this could easily be translated that Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius, even the reign of Cyrus the Persian, because those two may be the same person. We don't know for sure. It's just hard to know. Nevertheless, God continued to use Daniel for some time, even at this old age. And I can only assume that he got that promotion. He was probably promoted to the second in charge of the empire after this whole debacle with these satraps occurred. Listen, jealousy is a terrible thing. And it's sinful. Jealousy of other people is just dissatisfaction in the lot that God has given you. And it's sin. And it's worthless. And it doesn't change anything. Not everybody can be as attractive as the next person. Not everybody can be as strong as the next person. Not everybody can be as intelligent as the next person. But not everybody's saved by the grace of God. We need to be well aware that we are what we are by God's grace. And listen, sin hurts more than just you. Sometimes we think, well, I'm just hurting myself. Why do you care? Well, in the case of these satraps, it cost their family their lives. Sin hurts more than just you. At parents, I assure you that your sin affects your children. It does. Children, your sin affects your parents. Husbands, your sin affects your wife. Wives, your sin affects your husband. We could go on and on with that. And parents, your children have a soul that is going to spend eternity somewhere. And the sooner you come to grips with that, the better. Share the gospel with them. Keep the gospel near them at all times, the reading of it. Praying with them. Make sure they hear the preaching of the gospel. And notice in this passage, Daniel's continuous witness and influence on those around him. He was known to continually serve God. And kids, he built these principles very early in life. And they followed them through all the way to the end. Seniors, he's about 85 years old right here. But you're never too young to serve God, and you are never too old to serve God. We see all of that in Daniel. Finally, God does not always miraculously deliver the lives of His children when they're in harm's way. He does not. In Daniel's case, He did. In the case of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, He did. But He doesn't always do that. But He does always ultimately deliver His children. That we can be sure of. Our souls are delivered through life, death, and the resurrection of the perfect Son of God and faith in Him. And there's no other way for our souls to be delivered. We are saved by grace alone, through faith alone, in Christ alone, eternally. If you're a believer in Jesus, you have eternal life, which is far better than being delivered from a den of lions. Stand with me, if you will. There.